Hey guys, welcome to Listen Bitch Presents Tell Me Why You're Special. This is the arena where we don't just talk about crime, we talk about people because the truth is every courtroom has a story behind it. A choice, a moment, a life that went sideways somewhere. And when you spend years staring directly into violence and corruption and human darkness, it changes how you see the world. Most people never sit across from killers. Most people never walk through the aftermath of murder, but some do. And once you've seen that side of humanity, you don't unsee it. And God gave us free will, which means people are capable of both unimaginable evil and unbelievable redemption. So today we're talking about crime, justice, corruption, and the strange road that led one man from rock stages to homicide courtrooms. So let's get into that today. We have Greg Owen. He is a former rock musician turned Chicago murder prosecutor who spent years prosecuting some of the city's most violent crimes. So, Greg, thank you so much for coming in today. Take me to the first murder trial that got inside your head. What happened?
Did you say the first one?
Sure.
No,
Yeah,
I mean,
the first murder trial
okay.
that truly got inside your head.
Yeah, well, there was quite a few. I don't know why, but somehow I was lucky or unlucky to be selected to try cases that most people didn't want to try. And my whole position when I became a prosecutor from being a rock musician was that I wanted to give victims a voice. So when you talk about like the case that centers on my book Convergence, that was one that really left an impact on me all these years to this day. It's almost 49 years ago. We tried that case, my partner Mike Goggin and I, we tried the case in May of 1980. So what is it, 46 years old?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a long time. Well, the case centers on a double murder, stabbing murder. And the victims were 24-year-old Gio Messina and 22-year-old Tinker Moore. Now, they were stabbed to death in her Lakeshore Drive apartment in May, excuse me, March 3rd, their bodies were found, 1976. So 4 years went by.
Wow.
And what's sort of part of the concept of convergence was this. So 53-year-old Tony Messina, the father of Gio, he's been looking for him for 2 days. They work together. Tony has a very well-known business contracting firm in Chicago, and on the particular day, he hasn't heard from his son for 2 days. So he's getting a little frantic. His wife is
Yeah.
too. So he decides to drive south from where they lived in the North Shore to 2970 North Sheridan Road, which is where the girlfriend, Tinker, lived. He gets her, he sees his son's car parked out in front, which makes him even more concerned, okay? Now he's really upset.
Right.
He gets to the door. It's a big apartment building. He can't get in. He sees the janitor. The janitor lets him in the building, but he will not let him into the apartment. Tony finally persuades the janitor to open the door so he can go in because they've been pounding on the door, phone calls, no cell phones in those days, remember, no cameras.
Yeah.
So what happens is the janitor takes his key, puts it in the lock to this 131 was the apartment number, and he turns to Tony and he says, "The door's not locked," which was strange, right? I mean, they walk in, and there they find 22-year-old aspiring actress Tinker laying on the floor in a huge pool of blood.
Wow.
Tony walks in, looks to the left, in the bathroom, underneath the sink is his son, his only son. Well, at the moment he is finding his son, I'm at DePaul Law School taking Illinois bar exam. I left my band maybe a year before. I'd played for 10 years. And I was going to LA the next day. They were going to be recording an album in LA, my old band. And I figured I'd hang with them because it takes about 2 months to get your results. So
Yeah.
my mind was on one thing:
Oh,
go
yeah.
to LA, go to the record plant, hang with the band. So at the same moment this man's finding his son, I'm thinking about nothing other than this cute girl that's sitting next to me in the bar exam and going to LA. I mean, just like really lightheaded.
Yeah.
So I end up trying that case. And I get home from that bar exam in that day, bar exam, and I see the newspaper company, the Daily News, which was the evening paper at the time,
Yeah.
putting papers in a paper box. And the headline said, "Contractor, comma, actress found slain." There was a side panel to the article, And there was a very attractive young woman on the front, and it didn't have any money in my pocket. So I wanted to buy one, but I didn't have any money. So I go in the house. About an hour later, I get a call. I'm packing my clothes, go to L.A. the next morning. It's my brother. He sounds very depressed. I go, what's wrong, Jay? His name is Jay. He says, my friend and his girlfriend got murdered. I go, what friend? He tells me the name. Gio, I says, well, I don't know who that is. He says to me, well, you probably never met him. I was on tour all the time. See, I played in the band all through law school. I toured. I never stopped playing music.
Nice.
Law school, college, the whole bit. So what happened was, I said, wait a second. Where was your friend murdered? He goes, in Chicago, not too far from where you are. I said, wait a second. Was he a contractor? He goes, his dad is. Was the girlfriend an actress? Yeah, she just graduated from Goodman Theater Acting School. I just saw the headline. Now think about that.
Yeah.
A man finds his son. I'm not even a lawyer yet. And my brother calls. It's his friend that was murdered, one of two. 4 years later, Mike Goggin and I are prosecuting that case.
Wow.
That's a convergence, right? Just off the top of the period.
Yeah.
And so the case, the reason I made a point of writing this book with my co-author, Jonathan Dixon, was because every element of what was negative about the justice system is in this book. This case represented the worst of the worst. Judges had been bribed.
Oh, wow.
The state, my office, was going to dismiss the case. The only witness was said he was going to take the fifth. There was no physical evidence, had been stolen out of a police locker after the arrest. The defendant, a double murder, was arrested. He was 24 years old. He was from Northbrook, North Shore. And within 6 days, he first was put in the hospital for who knows what reason. And then a bond, which was originally said no bond, a new judge was assigned who ended up going to prison years later. And he was given a bond of $250,000 on a double murder, which is $25,000 cash.
Wow.
He was from an extremely, very well-known Chicago family. Wealthy, very wealthy. He gets out on bond. He's on bond for 4 years.
Living his life.
And finally, it gets to the point where the state's going to drop the case. I'm preparing another murder case. It's November of 79. I get a call from my brother. No, I've talked to him in between, but he calls me at the office. He says, you know, remember my friend's murder case? I go, not really. I go, yeah, I do now, a little bit. What happened? I said, what's going on with it? He said, your office said they're going to drop the case.
Oh.
I said, that's impossible. We don't drop that. We don't like dismiss. Well, that's what they said. He says, would you find out? So I told him I would. So I find out that the case has been assigned to the Chicago Daily Center. Murder cases are never assigned there, because they don't want people who have committed murder on bond or not associating with the people that are downtown in the Loop area.
Right.
So that was mysterious right away. How did they get signed there? How did the guy get a bond? I go down there, and there was the state's attorney's office, had some courtrooms we worked in, but they were more like grand theft, not crimes of violence. So it was highly unusual. And I can't find anybody. It's about 3 in the afternoon. Finally, I find somebody I know, and he says to me, Greg, you don't want to touch that case with a 10-foot pole. That case is the worst case. The witness is taking the fifth. The evidence got stolen from the locker. We have nothing else. We have no fingerprints, no footprints, no nothing. No weapon. And I said, well, just let me see it. He can't find it. Finally, he goes on his hands and knees, looks under somebody's desk.
Oh.
Literally, the file has been thrown under a desk. That's how bad the case was. I look at it, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is bad. But my brother wanted me to look at it, and I felt I was upset. I saw this guy, the defendant. He was so wealthy. I mean, so wealthy. I said, no, there's no way. I mean, I've seen people who I prosecuted, you know, who didn't have any money, and they didn't have the ability to hire good lawyers. He had the three best lawyers in Chicago, this guy already. So I called my partner, Mike. I said, Mike, we're probably going to lose this case, but I just want to at least, I don't know the people, my brother, give him justice.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. And then all the things that occurred from that point to the trial, in and by themselves, were all convergences, things that you never think could happen.
Yeah.
So, and the thing that was the most difficult for me, Brendan, is we never could prove a motive. The killer was their friend, and he stabbed them both to death with a butcher knife in front of somebody else.
Wow.
But he was their close friend. And we never could, there was no, never motive was impossible to prove.
Yeah.
So What else could I say?
Yeah. I mean, did what eventually happens with this guy? There was no
Well,
accountability for
he
him.
was on bond for 4 years. His attorneys, when it was in the other building, which was the Daily Center, had filed a motion to have all the evidence that had been seized in a search warrant
Yeah.
kept out of the trial or kept out of court. The judge
Wow.
granted it. Now, it just so happened the judge was close friends with one of the defense lawyers. What a coincidence in Chicago, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine? And so the state had to go, the prosecution had to go to the appellate court to get that judge reversed.
Wow.
But by the time they got him reversed, it was 2 years after the murders. And when they went to get the evidence, which had been taken to the appellate court justices to look at, the evidence had been taken. It was missing. There was no physical evidence. There was two little things. That's it.
Wow.
So there's no evidence. The only witness is taken the fifth, and we have nothing.
Yeah.
So I spent months speaking to this eyewitness to get him to be willing to testify.
Yeah.
And it was not easy. I mean, what I went through with this gentleman, his name was Cedric, he lived in Lake Forest.
Okay.
These people were all rich. He had a new Porsche. Everybody was rich. Cocaine was involved, okay?
Yeah.
And something in my head said, don't give up on this. Just keep going,
Yeah.
keep going. And I got to be really close with the victim's father, the contractor,
Yeah.
Tony. I mean, so close that when I had a son a few years later, Tony became his godfather. And
Oh.
he became like my surrogate father because my father was out of my life since I was very young.
Yeah.
So Tony actually helped give me advice on what to do, how to become a real, a father, a gentleman.
Yeah.
And so I owe a lot to him too. And so as I got closer to these people, I mean, it meant so much to them, and I wanted them to be able to be, so they knew they were heard, and
Right.
nobody else cared.
Right.
When I first found the case, one prosecutor said to me, "Why would you care about this? They were just a bunch of drug addicts."
Yeah.
I'm thinking, I spent 10 years in a band. And you're going to tell me
Yeah,
because
what?
somebody did some drugs, they deserve to be murdered?
Yeah.
So it was strange in those times. It was a
Yeah.
different world, you know.
What
So.
is this like this experience? What, because you're new and this is kind of a big thing that's unfolding in front of you to be a witness already to corruption, to how people with money are held to a different set of laws. Does it feel like, I mean, does it take your hope? Are you like, this sucks? Why am I even trying to do this? Is there a point where you're like, fuck the system, really? Like, what am I
You know,
doing?
yeah, I mean, it was so blatant, the corruption. I mean, in the system, it was every day. I mean, it was like, and when I first started, I was sent to a misdemeanor courtroom, a few of them. It took me about 10 months to be assigned to 26 of California, the felonies. But you got a real good look at corruption firsthand. I mean,
Yeah.
how lawyers would be handed cases by the clerk. Who they'd already worked out that the guy's bond was going to be sent to the lawyer and the judge was going to find him not guilty. This
Wow.
was going on every single day.
Yeah.
And the level of corruption was about as bad as it's ever been in the history of our country.
Yeah.
And it led to something which some people may not know about called Operation Greylord, which was
Never
the
heard of it.
largest investigation and prosecution of judicial corruption in the history of the United States. And it occurred right where I was working.
Wow.
I knew the mole. I knew the person who went undercover. We didn't know that he was doing it. In fact, we thought he had become a crooked lawyer. I mean, there's a
Wow.
story in here. I mean, the things that unfolded, like I said, we go to courtrooms and you prayed it. You were assigned to a courtroom where the judge wouldn't take money. I mean,
Yeah.
it was that bad. But, my attitude was, you still got to try. You can't just let this happen. You can't just lay
Right.
down. And I think the system itself knew the level of corruption. And so as a result, at 26 in California, where the big murder cases are tried, 95% of those judges were straight. They may have been more prosecution, more defense oriented, but there was two that I know of that took money, but that was it. Took big money too.
Yeah.
Judges I had worked in front of ended up being convicted.
Yeah. At least there was some accountability.
Well, there
I, you
was.
know.
And yeah, I mean, but there was nothing I mean, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
You can think and you can guess
Yeah.
and you know in a way, but you can't prove it.
Right.
But somebody went undercover and was able to prove it.
Yeah.
That all happened during the whole history of my career and part of what's in the book, Convergence.
Yeah. Well, I also want to go back a little bit because, I mean, you go from music to homicide prosecution. How, like, what was the shift there?
Yeah, that was, people ask me that. That's sort of an unusual combination of
Yeah.
careers. Well, my love was music, no question about it. My mother made me take piano lessons when I was 9 till I was 12, which I hated. And then I saw the Beatles. And I said, "Oh my God, this is what I want to do." Girls are screaming, you know, I was at the age of, "Oh, girls, you know, women, girl, they were girls at that point."
Yeah.
So we started a band. You know, me and my friend played guitar. And we were fortunate enough that we knew what was not good and what was good. And our bands were always good.
Nice.
And I don't know, about 16 and a half, I started touring in high school.
Nice.
And when I was in a band, there was something called the Vietnam War. And during Vietnam, if you weren't in school, you were going to get drafted.
Yeah.
So I stayed in college, and my professors were all so cool. I would be out of town, they would help me so I didn't flunk the exams. And then when I got done with law school, I mean with college, I was in a band called the American Breed, by the way. We had a song called "Bend Me, Shape Me, Any Way You Want Me,"
Nice.
which was a big record at the time.
Yeah.
And that band sort of broke up. And then my friend and I, the singer Bill Jordan, we were going to start a new band, which we did, and it got very popular. But I had nothing to do for a while. I had gotten a high lottery number, so I wasn't going to get drafted.
Yeah.
So he says, "Why don't you take some law classes?" I go, "What are you, nuts?" He goes, "How many times have we been screwed by managers who have lawyers who we sign contracts? We don't even know what we're signing." I go, "Oh,
Yeah.
that's absurd." I took about a couple of weeks and I said, "Well, maybe I could try."
Yeah.
So I took a law school admissions test, hair on my shoulders, and got accepted to four schools.
Nice.
So I picked one and I started law school. In January of 71, I started law school. And the first day I met with the dean, excuse me, and I said, "I have a special request." And he goes, "Yes, Mr. Owen." I said, "Well, I'm in a band." He goes, "Well, it's quite obvious." Now, when I was in law school, then guys
Yeah.
had real short hair were wearing sport coats. I'm in there
Suits.
with tie-dye shirts and
Yeah.
patches on my pants,
Of
platform
course.
shoes, the whole bit, earrings, braids in my hair. I mean, I was full rock and roll.
Yeah.
And I said, "I'd like to go to school every other semester." He goes, "Well, why?" I said, "Well, we tour a lot from June till January.
Yeah.
We don't tour so much in the dead of winter. We play more around the city, Chicago." He let me do it.
That's
So it took me
amazing.
5 years, but I went every other semester and I never stopped playing.
Yeah.
And then right about the time I was in my last semester of law school, I was in a relationship with a woman who I really cared about, and she ended up having an affair with a drug dealer, which is very demoralizing, you know.
Right.
And in fact, he tried to shoot me. That's part of it in the
Wow.
book. Yeah, it got a little contentious. So
Wow.
I started to think there's something about this music is not really working out. And then I went and saw a band called Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And
Okay.
Keith Emerson was a keyboard player. He was so good, it made me depressed. Now, I was pretty good.
Yeah.
And I thought, what career, what future do I have in music? I can't sing. If you can't sing, I don't care how good of a musician you are, you know, where are you going?
Right.
So I started to question my ability, and I was in law school. It was like at the end of February of 1975. I saw a note on a bulletin board that said, "Cook County State's Attorney's Office will be in room 202 on Thursday," whatever it was, day after I was looking at it, to interview for possible interns and then candidates to be prosecutors. And I'm looking at that note, and this is the God's honest truth. Something started talking inside me, which scared me. And it said, "Greg, you better do this or something bad's gonna happen to you." I'm like, I'm looking around, who's talking to me? No,
Yeah.
no, I mean, I was not into any of that hippie,
Right.
I'd done acid, none of that, no, none of that. And then I kept looking at it and it said it again. Now I'm getting really nervous. And then it said, "You better do this." And I'm like, I'm looking at myself. I thought I was crazy, you know. I go to the payphone, I call my mother, I go, "Mom, you know the guy that does your hair? Could you ask him to cut my hair tonight?" She goes, "Are you okay? What's wrong with you?" She thought I was crazy. So I got my hair cut. She took me to J.C. Penney, got me a suit. I went to an interview the next day. The guy said, "It's your lucky day. Supreme Court just passed a new rule that law students can try cases if they're in a government agency.
Wow.
So that's what I did. I went to an interview on Monday. That same day, I was sent to a courtroom.
Wow.
The most corrupt courtroom in the system.
Of course.
I walk in. I don't have a kid from the suburbs who was in a band.
Yeah.
It's like I fell out of a space saucer into another planet.
Yeah.
It was like another world. And after 2 weeks, I really liked it. I didn't like the corruption, but I liked the, I mean, I was used to being in front of people.
Of course.
So it was a lot of things you could correlate being on stage to being in a courtroom.
Yeah.
I was not nervous. You had to learn the language, but you know, you had to prepare just like you do in a band, you practice. You had to create witness lists like you do set lists. So a lot of it, it was just something I was motivated to do for, I don't know why, and I did it.
Yeah.
And it was the best thing I ever did.
I mean, that's, I feel like it's a little different performing in front of audience than it would be sitting across from people that are being accused of
yes,
murder.
It is
so
different.
Like, what is that energy like? I mean, murder
okay.
is
what is it like
murder.
To sit across from a killer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you have absolute disdain for him. Okay.
Yeah.
And sometimes the problem is you dislike that person so much, it sort of rubs off on their lawyer. And I tried not to let that happen where I was hating the lawyers as much as the defendant. But when you're dealing with murder, you know, somebody's not there. Somebody can't tell you what happened.
Right.
I'll tell you something that really bothered me once. I was pretty young. I was like 26, 27. I was doing a murder case. And a mother and father, I was interviewing them because one of them was going to testify. And the mother says to me, Mr. Owen, and I'm young, Mr. Owen, Mr. Owen, do you think he knew he was going to die, her son?
Aww.
Now imagine I'm 26 and I'm hearing that from a mother.
Yeah.
And then she says to me, how much do you think it hurt him? I mean, who is prepared to answer questions like that?
Nobody.
I mean, that stuck with me. I mean, you don't forget that, the horror of the what they think about their poor child, you know. And when somebody's shot, it's pretty quick. But when they're beat or stabbed to death, that's another story.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another story. And so when you're in the courtroom, you look across and you say to yourself, how could somebody do this?
Right.
You know. But then because you do so many of these cases, I had 61 murder jury trials.
Wow.
I had more jury trials, but 61 were murders. I don't want to say you get immune, but you just look at them and they're just the defendant. I'm going to get him. I want to make sure this guy does not leave this courtroom free.
Yeah.
Because I don't want him to go out and do something else to somebody else because I didn't do a good job.
Yeah.
So, and I took it as, I mean, it's a big responsibility when you're 27, 28, 29 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot. But you learn real quick. I mean, the crime rate was so high in Chicago, we were on trial every single week.
All
I mean, you couldn't even take a vacation. I mean,
yeah.
All the time on trial. And, excuse me. And because of that, well, let me say this. When I was toward the end of my career, I knew when I probably should leave because I was in a cafeteria and I was eating and I was preparing a case file. And I had a picture of a victim who had been shot with a shotgun in the head. And I'm looking at the pictures and I'm eating lunch.
Yeah.
And the lady that was bringing me the food, she dropped the tray when she walked up to me. And I'm like, what happened? Because I didn't even realize what I'm looking at is horrifying to people.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you know you're probably ready to leave.
Yeah.
Because you realize the pain of the family.
Yeah.
But a picture is nothing more than a piece of evidence you're going to use to convict that person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's part of that professionalism, right? You kind of have to take the emotion out of it because you can't get justice for a family if you are running on your emotions and you're letting things cause you to be reactive. So I see that. I guess it's the same way like in, you know, police work or ambulance drivers. Like there has to be a part of you that kind of shifts in that space. What did you learn about human nature? What's the biggest thing you were taught about human nature inside the courtrooms?
That I learned one thing, that jurors do listen. I mean, people do take it serious. I never really had a true feeling of what a juror was and what was their, how did they react? And we were able to talk to jurors after the trial was finished. And that's where you really learn about people. You know, you learn how the average citizen who is not accustomed to this, how they feel. And jurors try to be fair, but once they've reached that decision, I mean, they're locked in. And they will tell me about how horrific some of the stuff was that they'd seen or heard during the trial. And for human nature, in terms of, like, you know, witnesses, okay? I mean, think about being a witness to a murder. And now you have to come into a courtroom, bright, big marble walls, granite walls, whatever, and sit in the witness stand and have everybody looking at you. Witnesses at times were terrified. Terrified. And it was our job to help mitigate that terror. And so the way we prepared witnesses, that's when you learn this element of human nature. Like, what is it like to witness a murder? I mean, yeah. Not like a battlefield. I mean, a murder. And people were, I mean, they became quiet, you know.
Yeah.
Very withdrawn, oftentimes. And you have to get the witnesses to understand the importance of what they're doing, you know, yeah. And how they're serving society and their fellow man. And so we spent time preparing witnesses, especially those types. And then you really realize, I mean, it's hard to, you see, we did things that very few people were ever going to experience.
Yeah.
You know, either preparing a witness, arguing a case to have a person convicted of a serious crime. All those things are, unless you've been there, it's almost hard to define.
To explain it. Yeah.
How bad it was at times. Yeah.
That makes sense. You kind of said earlier that you tried not to hate the lawyer defending the murderer.
Right.
So my question is, like, how do you not do that? Because I'm looking at, you know, there's a very highly televised case of the FedEx driver, right, with the yep. little girl, and we're hearing and seeing stuff that's horrifying, and there's actually someone defending him. There's actually someone trying to humanize him, and I think it's hard not to judge that. Like, how do you not judge that? And how do you imagine they can separate their humanity to defend someone in front of a little girl's parents who admitted to what they did, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things I tried not to do is dislike the defense attorney outside of the courtroom.
Okay.
When you're in the courtroom, that's a different story.
Yeah.
That's like that's war in there. I mean, it truly is war.
Yeah.
And you try to stop them from doing what they're attempting to do at every turn, okay? But I always believe, now, every now and then you get some defense attorney who's, you know, a bleeding heart, that just, you know, that thinks for some reason the state screwed this person, yeah. And they didn't.
Right.
But, I mean, I'm friends with a lawyer judge named Sam Amirati. He represented John Gacy, John Wayne Gacy.
Okay.
I mean, he was doing what the Constitution, you have to have a lawyer. I mean, that's the way right. It is. Now, if a lawyer does their job, what it does is this, it keeps us all safe in a way from the justice system.
Okay.
You do not want a prosecution that is such that, you know, they just want to railroad people into jail, because that could be you or me someday. You
right.
know, we could be caught in that. So defense attorney's job is to make sure the state does a good job. I mean, they kept us on our toes.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way it should be. I mean, even as a prosecutor, I thought, well, we have a, beyond a reasonable doubt, we have a responsibility. I mean, you know, at some point you do have to look at the Constitution and say, well, that's how it is, I mean, in
right.
this country. And I know it's really hard to look at people that represent, oh, especially child killers or
yes.
kids that have been raped. I mean, yeah. that's tough. And yeah. don't get me wrong. These lawyers know their clients are guilty. They
right.
know it.
Right.
I mean, now, for me, I left the state's attorney's office. I didn't do well in private practice. I did financially well, but I didn't do well mentally.
Yeah.
I couldn't make the switch. Most, 95% of lawyers go from prosecutors then defense attorneys. Not me. I just couldn't do it. I, you know, like I said, I did well for a while, but then I just had to stop.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine that mental and emotional load. I think it would be a lot. What is something, because I mean, true crime is everywhere. People watch, the murder shows, it's everywhere. What is something that the public romanticizes about crime in courtrooms that is completely untrue?
Okay. One thing, it's not a matter of being untrue, it's something that the public doesn't know about. We've all seen, the cases in Massachusetts, Karen Reed, and all these different trials. And the thing that occurs is you're watching the trial and somebody asks for a sidebar. And then the fan starts turning, and you, as a person watching, you're just nothing. And they're in a sidebar. Those are the most interesting aspects of any case. What occurs, what you can't see, is more far more interesting than what you can see, because that's where you see the jockeying, you see the maneuvering, you see, you're arguing to a judge with nobody else there why your whatever you have to say should be allowed, and the other side said, "Oh no," but and the heat and the tension. All the tension you have for the defense attorney that you can't show in court necessarily, man, it comes out in the sidebars. I mean, there's almost fisticuffs. Sidebars, I mean, you walk out of a sidebar and you're like, oh. I mean, it's like adrenaline rush because it's so intense. And it's all on the record. See, it's all being recorded. So it's not like it's a separate trial. It's just the jury doesn't get to hear it. That's the most interesting part. And one of the things I did in the book, we did in the book Convergence, we put every sidebar in the book, because when you read it, that's what is really hard hitting, that went on when the jury didn't hear it. And we wanted to show the prosecution side, like most stories are about defense attorneys or the victim or the defendant. We posed the whole thing from what it's like to be the prosecutor of killers and what it takes. So I would say the biggest thing is the way trials are conducted. You see the lawyer goes running up to the witness and oh, Mr. So-and-so. It doesn't happen that way. There's no gotchas. Very, almost never did I have like, oh, you caught him. No, it doesn't work that way. It's very meticulous. It's very planned. And it's very tactical. I mean, for example, one thing you never see on television, and that's why we wrote these books, is because what happens really is more interesting than what you see on TV, because they don't know how to do it right. When we would have a witness on the witness stand, witness would be sitting there, the jury would be, say, alongside. Witness is usually close to the jury. We would always position ourselves when we're questioning the witness so that we would stand at the back of the jury box as far as we could. So when that witness is answering our questions, they're looking right in the jury in the face. Because then the jurors get a sense of the truth. Because they can see your eyes. And then what we would do tactically, when somebody was on the witness stand, we were cross-examining, we'd move to the center of the courtroom and ask questions from the middle. Because now the jury would get a sense, oh, this person must be lying because they're not looking at us anymore. So like I'm saying, if they did this, they showed what the strategy is, it'd be far interesting. I mean, if you saw a TV movie and you saw, oh, look at that prosecutor, that he just moved where he was asking questions, because now the jury's going to think the guy's lying because he's not looking at him anymore. We were that tactical. I mean, so I would say the way the cases are presented, I think they never show what it takes to put a witness on and what a witness goes through. Very well. I mean, and that's the most interesting part. Why you call witnesses in an order? Why do you call this one first and this one second? Why do you put a witness on just before lunch? What's the reason for that? Why? We did all that. We thought all that through.
No, that does make a lot of sense. I think that's incredibly interesting.
Oh,
We're
yeah.
coming up on our time right now, so I have one more question that I want you to tell
Sure.
people where they can find Convergence. I know you said that it was kind of similar walking on stage and standing in front of a courtroom, but which one truly was or could be the most intimidating at times? The musician or, you've got a murder jury staring at you?
Well, intimidating is one thing, and serious too. I mean, it's 100 times more serious to stand in front of a jury. I mean, it's not even close. I mean, I'm in a band, I'm having a good time. So yes, I think the most intimidating time for me is when one of the many cases I tried, we were seeking the death penalty. We were asking a jury to to vote that some would be put to death.
Kill someone.
That's pretty intimidating.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I bet it is.
Far more than a rock and roll band.
Right.
Yeah.
Where can, first of all, what are you doing now? You're not in the courtrooms anymore. So, what are you doing with your time? Are you?
Okay. So, we're writing book two.
Sweet.
There are going to be five books, and they're all based on the same characters, you know, myself, my partner, Mike, about cases that were just unbelievable. So that's what we're in. Jonathan Dixon and I are writing book two. I've created my first social media account on Instagram. I'm
Congrats.
Just about to hit 100,000 followers, which I thought
Congrats.
Was, I mean, I never did it in my life.
Yeah.
So apparently people like whatever I'm telling them.
Oh, yeah.
So I spend time with that. Book two, we're going to have a Substack soon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going very well. I mean, I'm enjoying it, you know, for what it is.
No, that's fun. And I think, I mean, you've collected enough stories that absolutely you should have that platform. So I'm glad you're on this social media network now. And where can people
Amazon,
find
you can find the book at Amazon,
Perfect.
Any of your book, Barnes and Noble, any major bookseller has our book, audio and the actual paper or hardcover version, both.
Perfect.
People love the book. It's good.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. This was a great conversation. It's just a window of what's in there. So, Greg, this is the part of the show where I get to tell you what I think makes you special. And it's not just the cases that you prosecuted. I think it's the perspective that you have really gained from all of this. You have seen both sides of humanity. You chose to hold on to yours. I think that's beautiful. Even with your creativity, the ambition, the music, and, you know, violence, corruption, the destruction, instead of turning away from it, like you just put yourself in the pit, carrying the weight of seeking justice in rooms most people could never emotionally handle. I think everything you've done has taken a lot of strength. I think it's beautiful that you are sharing all of these stories, that you're giving people a window into what it's really like there. You know, just you're bringing the humanity to something that people are already very interested in. So I think that's incredible. I think it makes you special. To everyone listening, you guys, choices matter. More than people realize, one decision can change a life, a family, a future. And every person has the capacity to either create something beautiful or destroy everything and everyone around them. That's why we have free will. And that means that what you choose matters deeply. So everything you're doing, I want you to be intentional. I want you to be aware. And please remember that your mess is your message. Even in the darkness, even the mistakes, even the moments that reveal the worst parts of humanity, there are lessons there, always. If this episode spoke to you, why don't we share this out for Greg? Okay, I know his book is going to be amazing. I'm excited to check it out. Convergence, you guys can get the link in the show notes. But share this out with someone that you think would be super interested. I know y'all are crime junkies, so I know you're going to go crazy here and leave my friend Greg some reviews for his episode. Stars are cute, but if you guys actually type something in, that's how Greg moves up in the algorithm with his name. So, and then if you guys are ready for the hot seat, I dare you to come tell me why you're special. Greg, this was awesome. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.